Hello, I'm Matt Bauman. Welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, Vegas in Space, and The Neverending Story. For this week's episode, I couldn't decide if I wanted to run an interview about horror movies, since October's about to begin, or about romantic comedies in recognition of Billy Eichner's new rom-com Bros. So I decided to run an episode about horror and romance. It's a revisit of my 2018 interview with Michael Verratti, Hollywood screenwriter responsible for such films as From Hell She Rises and Seven Dorms of Death, and also A Christmas Reunion and A Christmas in Vermont. Michael's genre hopping might seem a little strange, but he's not alone in straddling horror and rom-com. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, in case you haven't heard, I've got a book coming out next year about queer sitcoms. It's called Hi Honey, I'm Homo, and pre-orders are now open. Head over to gaysitcoms.com to get all the details. Also, big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Patrons get hours of exclusive bonus videos about pop culture history, stickers in the mail, and shoutouts in YouTube videos. Now, here's my 2018 interview with Michael. Well, this week I'm speaking to screenwriter and host Michael Verratti. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Oh, gosh. The entertainment that changed my life, and I've probably harped on this a time or two on my own show, so I'm sure some people are tired of hearing me rattle this cage, but it's really true. When I was growing up, I freely admit that there was a period of time where I was scared of everything. Like, I would not watch anything that seemed vaguely threatening. If the music would change on television to anything ominous, I would run over and turn the TV off, much to the dismay of my parents, who were usually watching whatever that it was I was rushing to stop. But I think there's something to be said about any of us who exist in the world of genre, that like you kind of obsessed with the things that you're afraid of and you kind of want to conquer it. And a lot of people who live in the world of the horror genre, a lot of our origins are similar in that we were scaredy cats but then couldn't, you know, get away from it. And there was a show that was on in the late 80s and early 90s called USA Up All Night that was regularly on Friday and Saturday nights, and it was hosted by this woman, Rhonda Shear, and Gilbert Gottfried would host on the alternative night, whatever it was. And they would show B-movies and cult movies and horror films. And I remember seeing a TV Guide listing for a double feature of Attack of the Killer Tomatoes and Return of the Killer Tomatoes in the TV Guide, and I, for some reason, was tickled by the title, and I was very much adamant that I needed to stay up and watch it. And my mom, knowing that I was easily horrified, was kind of like, okay, but maybe I should stay up and watch this with you. Just, you know, probably just in case. So we made popcorn. My mom sat on the couch. The show started. She promptly fell asleep maybe 15 minutes in, and I watched both movies. And how it used to go with Up All Night is after the first double feature, they would just show both of the movies back to back to back until, like, morning. And I ended up sitting there and watching both of the movies a couple times because I was so enraptured. And it's not necessarily that Killer Tomatoes was like Citizen Kane or anything, but I think what had happened was I had this sort of revelation that there was a whole different world of art and a different world of cinema than the kind of movies I was going to see at the theater. And I loved that. And I instantly kind of had like a change of life. And I started wanting to seek those movies out, the movies that seemed like a little naughty, a little funny, the ones that there was sort of a culture that seemed to suggest these are not films that were made for mom and dad or that you shouldn't be watching these. But I was drawn to it because early on, I just think I liked the subversion of it. And as I grew up, I became really fascinated with the power those kind of movies have in making statements and social commentary as well. But it's funny that of all of them, the ones that definitely was the pivot point was a movie about Killer Tomatoes.
Across this great nation, almost everyone has been affected in one way or another by this terrible tomato onslaught. Mrs. Williams, I understand your husband is missing.
Yes,
do you think he's dead?
Well,
will you miss him?
Well,
will you marry again? What if he's laying in a ditch somewhere, like with both his legs broken, calling your name? You will have to find another man, you know. You're no spring chicken.
So. I can't tell you how delighted I am that we're going to talk about Rhonda Shear. I'm a big fan. Can you describe, like, we're going to talk about Up All Night.
Okay.
But just starting with Rhonda, like, what are you seeing? What are you getting on the screen when she pops up?
Well, I mean, she was your video vixen, Rhonda Shear. She was a blonde and bubbly ingenue, I guess, would be a word. And she had big 80s hair that was bleach blonde, and she usually was wearing some sort of very small attire. And she had this kind of curated Valley Girl persona that she was just there for a good time and like a slumber party, and she was hosting these movies. And in a way, I really think the power of someone like Rhonda and Elvira or Joe Bob Briggs, who had these sort of like hosted midnight movie shows that were sort of a conduit to a whole generation to cult and horror cinema, was there was a safety to it. Because, you know, even if it started getting a little tense, Rhonda would break in and be like, isn't this dumb? And then you'd like, it was like you were watching with a friend and you would laugh with her.
Hi, it's Rhonda. And to get you into the Halloween spirit, we've got Nightmare on Elm Street and Fright Night 2 next on USA Up All Night.
And she to me was my gal, because that was the show that was my introductory into this world. But she's like quintessentially 80s mall girl, party girl, a little bit of Elvira mixed with Playboy Playmate mixed with the Sherman Oaks Galleria. I mean, that's who Rhonda Shear was. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah, she's just an absolute delight. I unjustifiably, I think, overlooked by a lot of queer men today. Like, there's so many elements of her on-screen persona that are so campy and appealing.
Sure. And you know what the thing is that people maybe who don't remember the show don't recall is that Up All Night actually frequently engaged with, air quotes, counterculture and queer culture in ways that no one else on cable television was doing at that time. Like, for example, they showed the all-drag space movie Vegas in Space on USA Up All Night. So here you have an all-drag queen movie on cable television in the early 90s, which, like, no one was showing queer content at all then. And not only did they show the movie, but Rhonda had Philip Ford, the director, and Miss X, one of the stars, on the show. And then there's an episode of Up All Night where Rhonda went to Drag Strip 66, which was a very famous drag venue here in Los Angeles, and she spends the night hosting the show amongst drag queens. And if you are familiar with drag culture, like, you can see early glimpses of Jackie Beat and like Gina Loterman and some of these other queens who are very pivotal to the LA queer and drag scene of that time. And still, in this episode of USA Up All Night. And so what I really like about Up All Night, even though I didn't realize it then, because I was just trying to watch like Friday the 13th or, you know, Vampire Bikini Beach or whatever they were showing, is that it was sort of a conduit to queer culture that I maybe wasn't even aware I needed until later. And there is, that's what I mean about the subversive commentary of the power of this material. Rhonda took us there, and Elvira herself is a drag queen by her own admission. So, like, we were kind of getting tastes of it in different ways, and it was filtered through this midnight movie lens, which, you know, for a kid like me is all I could ever ask for.
You mentioned that it was very different from the movies that you were going to see in theaters or with your parents. What was the other world that you were in, the other world of movies that you thought was, well, this is it, before you discovered Up All Night?
Well, I mean, I think like a lot of kids of my era, it was a lot of Don Bluth, you know, An American Tale, Land Before Time, or whatever Steven Spielberg was doing, or Back to the Future. There were sort of these big pop culture milestones that, I mean, people are still clinging to because they were pivotal cultural moments, and nostalgia is very powerful. And it's not that I instantly turned away from those things. I love those things. I remember seeing a lot of them in the theater and worshiping those and obsessing about those as well. But there just was something really unique to me about seeing this cinema that represented otherness. And, you know, because E.T. is not the Toxic Avenger. Like, you know, it's just like, that's just, they represent a very different kind of worldview. And I became very interested in that. And I reference otherness because in my work discussing the intersection of queer identity and the horror genre, that's something that we come back to a lot. And a lot of people who are interested in horror who are queer, whether we all realize that overtly or not, there is this sort of relationship of, like, you know, the horror is about the outsider. Cult cinema is about finding your community. There's always this seed of otherness that, who understands being other more than queer people? And I think that I became obsessed with those movies because, even though I didn't know it, not yet, they were kind of me. I, you know, as much fun as it would be to be the king of the prom, you know, most of us are Carrie. You know, that's just how it goes. Mm-hmm.
What you mentioned, like a lot of, you know, the big sort of mass market pop culture touchstones, like American Tale, but those are also, you know, American Tale has that extremely scary fire scene around the end. At like, there are scary things there. So, like, how did you like cope with scary stuff as a kid? I think you mentioned that like you just had to leave the room, right?
I did, but you know what's interesting is, I think the entertainment for children of yesteryear was much more savvy and respected kids more than it does today. And I think of things like Neverending Story, where the horse gets swallowed by the swamp. Like, what a kind of a devastating moment that is. But it also respects the audience. And by the audience, I mean children, enough to realize that they can understand that there are stakes involved in this kind of tale. And I think on a lot of the things that we were given then, as opposed to how it's presented now, it's as if they don't think kids today can handle it. I frequently do panels with fellow queer filmmakers and people in the horror space, and Jacqueline Chesson, who's an amazing filmmaker, who I frequently do panels with, recently said that maybe her gateway into horror was Walter Murch's Return to Oz, which she said part of it, that movie is very horrifying, and it's true, because, you know, it's a tale of Dorothy who is not believed by Auntie M, and she's getting shock therapy for it, and it, like, kind of suggests that they think she's crazy, and then that she goes to this dark version of Oz where a woman has decapitated heads in cases. But this is a movie made for children. I don't think if we tried to pitch that movie to a studio today, it would ever fly, because it's too much. I was a scaredy cat, but I think that, like, I always kind of took things into the context of the way they were presented. And even then, there were stuff I didn't like. I mean, I remember being completely horrified when Ursula gets impaled by the ship at the end, because I thought it was so very violent. Little did I know what was to come in my life. But I don't know. I think that it's all about context.
So what were the things that scared you as a kid? Like, what were the scary scenes or scary characters that you were like, nope, this is too much?
Oh my God, who's even to say? Like, the thing is it was just always like, I just loved my like bright and cheerful little kid world. And if music would change on TV, when I say that, like, it's my parents' favorite story because of the work I do now. If like the music turned suspenseful, I didn't want, like, because I was afraid something would pop out and scare me. But when I say that, you know, I was very young. Like, my turnaround happened pretty quick, because after I discovered USA Up All Night, I started reading Stephen King, and I became interested in some of the more outrageous titles at the video store. So when I leaned into it, it was sort of like a switch, and I like leaned into it hard. But like, yeah, anything that just seemed like threatening, which to a little kid, everything's threatening. But then when I decided I was ready to be threatened, I just was like, let's go.
Yeah, it sounds like for you, it was often either something really like violent, like the impaling of Ursula is indeed something to be upset about.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like the jump scares, which I totally get because I'm an extremely jumpy person. I recall like thinking back, there's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation where it's the one where they first encounter the Borg, that as a kid when that was on, I probably tried to watch that 3 or 4 times before I could make it all the way through, because I was so troubled. And looking back, like, the thing that horrified me about it was the possession, the taking of someone's body. And to this day, like, it's very difficult for me to watch First Contact, which I recognize as one of the best Star Trek films. But there's just something about, like, assuming control of someone else's body or someone assuming control of your body that I'm like, this is giving me so much anxiety. I can't deal with this media that is happening in front of me right now.
I can totally see that. Yeah.
And so I wonder, like, for you, are there things that you found that are successful scares? Like, how much do you think about the psychology of what is scary in your work? Which, actually, we should probably talk about what your work is. Like, what is it that you do for a living these days?
Well, I always say I live a few different lives, and they're all in tandem. But I most primarily am a screenwriter, and I started in the world of indie horror films. I wrote a number of different little indie films that went on to have considerable success and nice festival runs. And then there's sort of a divergent point where I continue writing films, but because of the work I did in the indie genre space, I fell into the world of writing television movies. And I wrote a number of holiday films for networks like Lifetime and Hallmark and Ion. And I'm continuing working in the TV space. I just finished a sci-fi disaster movie for the producers of Sharknado. I also just wrote a new thriller for Lifetime. And I continue to write, and I, you know, I produce things for other people, usually in the queer space. And I've also started directing. I just directed a short, wrote and directed a short called He Drinks, which is a queer comedy that premiered at Outfest. And I continue to move on with all of that. So, I mean, it's all sort of always wrapped up creatively, whether horror is my foundation, but I do branch off into other genres. And I primarily think of myself as a writer, but I produce and direct as well. But in tandem with all of that, I've always been very interested in this intersection between the queer identity and horror. And from the very beginnings of all of this, I've been writing articles about it and speaking on it. And because I've been sort of rattling this cage and loud about it for so long, I kind of got momentum in that space as someone to talk to about this, which I'm very humbled and grateful for. And one of the first major gigs that landed for me was as the curator and host of San Diego Comic-Con International's annual queer horror panel. And I've been hosting that for a number of years, and I've had great honor of having such people as Brian Fuller, executive producer of Hannibal, or, you know, Mark Patton from Nightmare on Elm Street 2, or Gwen Turner, who wrote the screenplay for American Psycho. A number of, like, Christopher Rice, people have come and shared their stories and their trajectory and how their queerness influences their work in genre, etc. And I was approached about a year and a half ago by a streaming platform, Reverie, to maybe do a project with them. And we had gone back and forth on a few ideas that just weren't gelling. And they were, to their credit, were very fascinated by the work that was being done annually at Comic-Con. And we had a conversation about it. And I had the realization that while the conversations at Comic-Con get a lot of press and are doing a lot of good in the space and increasing the visibility, it's really an hour a year with six people. But what if I was able to take those stories and have an hour a week with one person and preserve the queer history and the horror history? And I created a show called Dead for Filth, which is my podcast that I host weekly. And a lot of the people I've mentioned who have been on my panel at Comic-Con have also done my show, as well as a number of others. And so while I'm writing movies and creating movies, I'm also working constantly to preserve the history of queer identity within the world of genre, because it's been so important to me. And as I'm discovering, it's been very important to a lot of people. So I wear a couple different hats, but that's I think that's a nice overview.
It is very strange to look at your IMDb page, because you've got, like, Broadcasting Christmas and A Christmas Reunion right next to Flesh for the Inferno. How did all that Christmas stuff happen?
Well, you wouldn't think they're related, but what happened was a producer I know who works in the world of TV had contacted me when what happened was one of the networks had ordered a number of holiday films, and they discovered they didn't have enough scripts to fill the slots. And they needed to get a script turned around relatively quickly. And he knew me from my work in the world of genre. And one of the things when you are working in the world of low budget is you really learn how to write with what you've got. And one of the things I'm proud about the success of our low to no budget movies is we sort of took stock of, like, what we had, and that's how we made the movie, utilizing the skills and talent we had, rather than write something grandiose and then just kind of, like, try and shove it in that box. And in a way, they were looking for someone who could quickly and effectively tell a good story with the resources available for that quick turnaround time for Christmas. And he took a chance, and he called and asked, hey, do you want to write a Christmas movie? And honestly, up until that phone call, was it something I had ever thought about? Not really, but I love a challenge. And so I said yes, and it did well enough that they asked me back to do another, and then another, and I've got more on the way. And I did an interview with the Wall Street Journal a couple years ago because they became very fascinated with kind of like a small group of us who straddle this world of horror and holidays. And they did a piece where they talked to a handful of people who do this. And I said, I was like, you know, I know that they're very different films. And for a lot of people, it seems mystifying that we can do both. But when you think about it, they're both a community of films that are built on expectations. So in a way, they're both cult cinema, just in different ways, because the audience of a holiday movie tunes in with specific ideas of what they're looking for when they tune into Hallmark to watch a Christmas movie. There are rules, there are ideas, and such is the same with a horror audience. And so when you can kind of understand the community and or cult that is existing around the genre of film you do, you can have a lot of fun with it. And it's also like, by knowing the rules, you can break the rules. I enjoy writing both of them equally because I don't take on any writing project that I can't make my own and I can't give 100% to. And it's sort of a nice mental cleanse. Like maybe I write something very dark and ooky spooky, and then like the next project I let Melissa Joan Hart become the premier talk show host of the Christmas season, you know. So it's just kind of, it's fun. I like it. It looks like more of an identity crisis to an outsider than it is for me, I think.
I can certainly see the both of them require a certain discipline when it comes to meeting expectations of the genre. But I imagine that, like, some of the specific tools that you're using are probably very different, like for establishing tension, for example, in a horror film. Well, I don't know. Like, you're clearly like evoking a very different set of emotions in the audience. But ultimately, does it always just come down to that setting up a tension and then really? I just watched Nanette where she talks about Hannah Goodby talks about like that tension and release. Is that essentially what you're doing in whatever genre you're working in?
Sure. Well, I mean, I want to speak to the tension and release thing first, because one of the things that I think that people don't realize, because most of the Christmas movies fall into the realm of what would be considered romantic comedy. And comedy and horror always straddle a very thin line with one another, because it's all about release. It's just a different kind of release. A friend of mine, Daniel Montgomery, always says they're the same in the way that you're seeking to control an audience's breathing, except one is through laughter and one is through fear. And it's just a small difference of a mechanism of how you do that. But every writer is different. Now for the broader question about, you said, like, you know, straddling those lines, every writer is different and every writer has different strengths. One of the things that I really am proud of and is my kind of skill in the world of writing is character creation and dialogue. Once I know who my characters are, I can pretty much move through a story. And in that way, because people ask, like, well, do you write a horror film differently than a Christmas movie? And the answer is not really, because I just need to know who my characters are. Because when you are, one of the biggest mistakes I see for beginning screenwriters, especially writing genre, is they tend to write movies where it seems like the characters are aware of the kind of movie they're in, and that's not the way the world works. You don't know whether you're living in a romantic comedy or a horror movie. And it's when you wake up in the morning to get in the car to drive to grandma's for Christmas, you may make it there, and then you have a Christmas movie, or your car may break down on the way, and you may have to use a phone at the castle a few miles back. But like, when you get up in the morning, you don't know. And so you have to know who the characters are who are waking up and going into that world. And that's how I establish it. Like, I never write characters differently. I write how, once I know who they are, I write how they would react to the situation they're in. And in that way, it's all just a big world that exists in my head. I mean, in some cases, maybe the horror movies and the Christmas movies all happen in the same world, but they're just not aware of it.
There's just one big, like, horror holiday cinematic universe where...
Right.
I like what you said about, like, you leave the house and either you're going to a Christmas party or you're going to a castle. And it right. could go... just depends which road you take.
Oh, I mean, true. I mean, like, how many of us, you know, not to put a dour note on it, and I'm fine, so I don't mind bringing it up, but I had... About three weeks ago, got in my car to go meet a friend after a fairly successful and busy day of work. We were going to meet up and have dinner, and on the way, someone rear-ended me on the highway. And it was a very traumatic and not great moment. And, like, you know, I had to deal with all of that, like, had to make sure that I was fine, my car was not fine, et cetera, et cetera. But when I left the house, I didn't know that that was what was in store. And so that's sort of just the same of the characters in a fictional world. I think that, you know, when you're in a Christmas movie, you don't know you're in a Christmas movie. Christmas just happens to be happening. And when you're in a horror movie, until that first thing occurs, until you get hit on the highway, you don't know that's happening. That's just, to me, how you curate stories. You make it relatable through the people. Plot, of course, is great. Every movie needs a plot, but a plot is nothing if you don't have people to interact with it.
Are there things that scare you now, or have you basically just conquered fear because you spend so much time with it?
Cinematically, I'm not easily to frighten. I think the truth is that when you live in the world of genre material, there are very few horror fans that will tell you that we're still scared by movies. But I don't think being scared by horror films is at all, you know, the sole reason that we go to them. I think there's a multitude of things. Of course, in the real world, I have fear. I think that everybody does. Like, the only people who have no fear are usually crazy people. I know that's not very NPC to say, but it's true. I mean, we live in a very kind of dire time where anything could happen and everything is uncertain. I worry and have fear for the world outside and the people and just sort of the people in it. I try not to fixate on it, but that's the truth. It's like you kind of have to go into the world bracing yourself, not knowing if your day is going to be the romantic comedy or the horror film, and just hope for the best. And when you really start thinking about that, that is kind of terrifying.
Well, yeah, I guess, do you find that thinking about horror as a genre, like, which is always sort of fantastic horror, the stuff that happens on screen generally is not stuff that we'll ever actually have to face. Does that give you sort of a release from having to worry about more real-life-y things?
Well, absolutely. In fact, that, like, you want to get into the sociology of it all. That truly is actually why the horror genre tends to be very popular. Despite what maybe like the industry would want to tell you, demographically speaking, horror tends to do its best during time periods of turmoil. And it's because I think audiences tangibly can go in and release the fear that they have for the world outside by placing it on something fantastic and otherworldly. Wes Craven famously said, "We don't go to movies, horror movies, for fear. We go to them for catharsis," and that's very true. And you know, even during the Great Depression, of course, they were making all these cheerful Frank Capra movies that they thought were cheering people up, and maybe they were, but that's also during that era when Universal's monster movies really hit their heyday, and it's because the world outside had true horror, but like if you could invest it into Dracula or Frankenstein and put it away and send it away by the credits, you get that momentary release where you aren't necessarily acknowledging the thing that scares you, but you're getting it out. And that's been true throughout history. And horror tends to all, like, the kind of horror that runs parallel with the world usually reflects what sort of the mores and fears of the time are. Like, when you look at when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, it's very much about the debate of God versus science. And that was a huge topic that was dividing a community then. Godzilla is a response to the use of atomic weaponry. Even Saw and Hostel and the so-called torture porn movement came about during the midst of George W. Bush's reign and the Abu Ghraib torture situation in the news. And now we're seeing a lot of horror movies that deal with social justice issues, like Get Out. And in an era where Donald Trump is really, you know, kind of trying to force us all back into boxes. So I think that we need that catharsis. And yeah, so, you know, the long answer around to your question is it is helpful because it's both release and it helps us put it away. I mean, we're not ignoring the horror of the real world, but it's nice to not deal with that and just deal with a monster for a minute, you know?
Have you had cathartic experiences in horror films, either ones that you've worked on or ones that you've just gone to see?
Sure. I mean, I don't know if I can think of like an example right now because I live with this stuff so much. But yeah, there's always a little bit of catharsis. I think that, Get Out, I think I remember, I don't want to have spoilers for it, but I remember even seeing Get Out with an early audience and how when you kind of figure out what the plot is and our hero has to turn it around on them. I remember a distinct moment where the people cheered for him and a surprise that happened. And it wasn't just because of him. I mean, of course it was. We were all wrapped up in the story. But like that moment was also a commentary on the shit that was going on outside. And that's true, I think, across genre, not just horror. Like when you look at the response to Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman, that was cathartic for people. To people who don't even care about superhero movies. My mother called and said, because she went and saw it, and she's like, you know, this really isn't for me. She said, but I have to say, when I was a little girl, I never thought that I would get to go see a movie where the woman was the hero. And that statement alone, that's catharsis, because it's sort of like she got to live long enough to see someone that she always wanted to see, even if it's not in a genre that she fully connects with. I think that catharsis has many layers, and horror and the fantastic and science fiction and fantasy, it all serves it in different ways. And that's exciting to me. You know, that's why we do this. It's easy to brush these kind of movies aside because they're not necessarily the Oscar bait kind of films that the Academy likes to venerate, but truth is, genre, when done right, can serve as commentary for things that maybe they're not willing to say yet. And that, to me, is why we need it. I mean, as much as we need the escapism, too.
How much of yourself do you put into your films?
How much do I... I'm okay. Well, I mean, I always put a little bit of myself. I think one of the things that I frequently get chastised for when I'm writing for network is I tend to always have a character who's a little too quippy or dry. And that character is usually me. I found that sometimes to avoid putting myself throughout the movie, I choose like one person to install myself into so that they're kind of like my passive passenger self in within the narrative. But yeah, I do think that there are no writers out there who would tell you that we don't bring a bit of ourselves to what we write in different ways, because otherwise it's just not genuine. Like that's you bring your experiences and you bring yourself. It's like the question of like, do you feel responsible to include queer characters in narratives? It's not that I'm like actively thinking about it when I write stuff, but my experience is a queer experience, so queer things are going to end up in my work regardless.
You mentioned getting some pushback on the quippy characters, so I'm assuming it's sort of like your Xander characters who are sort of ironically detached?
Yeah, I will say, and I've said this time and again when Buffy comes up, I tend to actually be one of the few fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer who is vehemently not a fan of Xander, but I do appreciate, I do understand what you're saying. I just like, for myself, I'm like, I refuse to acknowledge any Xander association.
What's your problem with Xander?
My problem with Xander is that Xander is completely representative to me of a toxic masculinity in the Buffyverse. Early on, there's sort of the narrative that he is in love with Buffy and sort of feels like he deserves her. You can kind of see that in the narrative. And he also feels like he gets dominion and opinion over her life as her friend. And in the meantime, he also treats the women that he is romantically involved with terribly. I mean, he leaves Anya at the altar and he leaves Cordelia impaled on the floor, yet still somehow is critical of how Buffy runs relationships with Angel and Riley. I'm not saying that Buffy and Xander shouldn't be friends, but it's sort of like from the outsider point of view, Xander is problematic in the way that he still, despite everything, thinks that he is unabsolvable. He thinks that he can have a say in Buffy's life and that he deserves a say in Buffy's life, despite all of the kind of things that he's done. I'm just not a Xander fan. I think that there are far better people for Buffy to be spending time with. And that doesn't mean that I necessarily think she needs to hook it up with Angel or Spike either. I just never really liked how Xander treated her or the women that he was romantically involved with. It bothered me in the 90s and it bothers me now.
So just you'd like to see a more, I don't know, compassionate isn't exactly the right word, but I guess Xander just minding his own business a little more.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. It's like, we all make mistakes. I certainly have. I think the truth is, when you're in the world of dating and the world of friendship, it's easy to believe that we are always the protagonist of every story, but that's not true. Humans are shades of gray, We're sometimes good guys and sometimes bad guys all wrapped into one. And, you know, it's important if you are the bad guy in a scenario or you didn't handle something the way you should have, you should learn from it. And Xander certainly never learned from it. I mean, the one thing that I think is really fascinating about Buffy is Buffy makes mistakes in the show, but I feel like she tries to better herself, whereas Xander kind of gets sort of this straight white male pass throughout. I mean, which is very interesting in a very pro-feminist show. I don't know. It's just always been like a thing. I've been a guest frequently on several Buffy podcasts, and everyone's always fascinated by my kind of total disinterest in Xander.
I certainly get it. Like, I put him at the bottom of my list of favorites from the regulars. And I hadn't really thought about just the way that he kind of butts into Buffy's life in a way that he's not particularly. Well, I don't want to say that he's not like giving, because, you know, obviously he puts himself on the line for her, but his motivations may not be entirely as altruistic as you'd want them to be.
Right. I think he's the kind of man who would complain about being friend-zoned.
What of the characters that you've written, it sounds like, I don't know, maybe like they're sort of Jughead characters where they are the ones who are just standing on the outside of the periphery and watching and talking about what's going on. Is that the kind of character that you tend to invest yourself into?
Yeah, of course. I think you mentioned Flesh for the Inferno. I wrote a character in that movie called Ian, who is sort of a beleaguered theater kid who's part of the group. Whose parents force him to go to this this cleanup effort where they accidentally unleash the demon nuns, and he didn't even want to be there. It's sort of that, you know, I didn't even want to be here today kind of attitude. But I utilized him as a character who was sort of my lens of, like, all these other people are, like, really into this, and it's just like, I didn't want to be here, and I don't know why I'm involved in this. And, you know, that particular archetype of character in my work exists in different ways, even in, like, the television films. He or she just changes depending on the script. For example, I just did this movie called The Wrong Stepmother, which is in production now, which I believe is going to be on LMN here in the future, and there's a character in that named Patrick who is, without question, the lead girl's gay best friend, and I wrote that as such because I wanted to see more of that kind of representation on television. And Patrick's sort of the one who's like, I think your stepmom might be a crazy killer person, and he engages in helping on the way, but whereas everyone else is sort of a very more serious Lifetime movie sort of character because they have to be and stop this evil woman, he kind of like pauses and it's just sort of like, you know, I just wanted to go to school this afternoon and now we have to, you know, go save this person instead. That, you know, and I think that everyone deals with trauma differently, and that's how I deal with trauma, as I was sort of like amuse myself. So it doesn't mean I'm not affected by it. It's just that's my coping mechanism. So for me, it's very organic to have those characters.
Can you describe a time in your life when you've used that technique in life rather than as a screenwriting technique?
Sure, I guess. I think that I'll just bring it back to the being rear-ended on the highway the other day. It was a hit and run situation. This man hit my car and then drove off. And, you know, they didn't know if I was hurt, or not. And when you're on the freeway in Los Angeles, that's not a slow speed of travel. And the back of my vehicle was completely destroyed. It blew the windshields in and things. And I, had to pull off and wait for the police, and I was just standing on the side of the road. It was that day that it was 108 degrees here in the city, so it was already kind of awful. My back hurt, my car is broken, and this guy pulled up alongside me, and he was like, hey, is everything going all right? And I looked at my car, and I looked at him, and I was just like, yeah, man, just peachy, you know, just waiting on a friend. It's like, because what? My car's destroyed. What do you mean, is everything all right? That's a low grade example, but that's like, you know, probably the best in most recent, where it's just sort of like, yeah, I'm just going to make fun of this because what else can I do? It's already done. And that's sort of that, you know, and it doesn't mean that I didn't deal with it later and I didn't unpack it later, but it's sort of like in the moment, sometimes humor keeps you strong. And at least that's how I work. And I think that's how a lot of comedians work. I mean, like, no, most people in the world of comedy would say that you turn your pain into a joke. And in that way, it goes back to our conversation about horror as catharsis or controlling your own breathing. It's sort of like through the laughter, through the fear, you just kind of get it out and then you move on. And I wouldn't consider myself a comedian or comedy writer, but like, I definitely get the power of it.
And I was just about to ask, is horror a form of comedy?
To me, absolutely. I mean, of course it is. I've always said that. When have you never been with a group of friends watching a horror movie and something patently absurd happens and you just start laughing? That's a natural reaction.
Why is that? Why do people laugh at something horrible?
Because it's unexpected. And I think it's because it's sort of like, you know, we laugh in order not to cry. I think that, you know, there is still, it's not laughter like, ha ha, although sometimes it is in film, but it's just sort of like, that's an involuntary coping mechanism. I mean, there's a psychology there that I don't even necessarily want to begin to touch upon because I'm no way qualified. But yeah, I mean, you look at something like, and I think a whole generation of horror film creators and writers and people have tapped into that humor and they understand there is something to that. You look at the Evil Dead, the original Evil Dead, and the sort of like dread that movie is steeped in. And then you look at the sequel, you know, this exact same creative team, and it's Looney Tunes. It's almost like there are sections of it that are almost like a Three Stooges routine, because so heightened and over the top. And that's Sam Raimi being very aware that this is scary, but it can be funny too, and maybe the audience needs that. Maybe we don't necessarily need to live in the dread place the whole time, and we can give them the release through the laughter. And I'm very fascinated by that kind of strange relationship. And I said it earlier, it's a thin line that exists between them. So why not play with it? Because we all kind of laugh at shit anyway, and I think it's just how we make it through our day in reality, so it makes sense that it would exist in our entertainment as well.
You know, what you're describing reminds me of, I just watched do you know the clip from One Tree Hill? It's sort of infamous, the heart transplant scene?
Oh, with the dog, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's horrifying. It is a horrifying moment to think about, but it's also, you know, you have to laugh because it's like, that's the way they presented it. I mean, if that happened to, like, your brother, cousin, friend, dad, whatever, and, like, this heart was the way they lived and just some dog in a hospital came and ate it, like, that's awful. Like, that's horrifying. But when you're watching it in the context of a teen melodrama on the CW, and, like, it's like, this is where the writer's room decided to go, pour a glass of wine and have it out. Like, that's funny. You know, it's gotta be. Because it's sort of like that thing, like, if this happened in real life, you wouldn't believe it. Like, you know, how people frequently say that. So it's just sort of like, go with it.
You know, we've been talking about the connection between horror and comedy and people kind of processing their fears through sort of abstract fears on screen. Are there things that you've put in movies that you yourself are afraid of?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure. I definitely, the things that frighten me tend to be very tangible things. In that, I mean, I guess, you know, it's the quote, all monsters are people. And I believe that. Like, I am not someone who really worries that aliens are going to snatch me from my evening walk, or that if my house is haunted, you know, I don't think about stuff like that. Am I a Scully about it? Do I doubt they exist? I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm not the be-all, end-all opinion on everything. Maybe there are ghosts. Maybe there are aliens. Like, I have not encountered any that I know of, but they could be out there. But I'm just choosing not to worry about it. And if there's a ghost in my house, the truth is they're probably more afraid of me than I am of them. But
actually, that reminds me of something. What was the horror film that Eddie Izzard was in? Was it the 1313 Mockingbird Lane reboot? Anyway, whatever it was, there was some line where the wife, he plays like the scary dad, and the scary wife says something like, what will the neighbors think? And he says, they should be more worried about what we're thinking about them.
Cover yourself. What will the neighbors think?
The neighbors should be more concerned with what I'm thinking.
I put fears of mine into scripts, but they usually have to deal with other people, like the invasion of space, that feeling of violation if someone's been in your home, like the idea, or those kind of things. I think about those because those are things that could happen. That to me, like when I watch a movie about home invasion, always bothers me more than, you know, Godzilla tromping around downtown. Now, of course, if I'm in downtown LA and there's a giant monster, I'm not going to be like, oh, well. But it's less likely than, you know, someone breaking into my car. Yeah, so, but that to me is, that is the thing that scares me. Those are the things, other people. And, you know, in a world of increasing catfishing and violations and school shootings and where every space you have to kind of always be consciously aware, those fears are tangible. And so those are things that I put into work because they're things that I think about. And I think they're things a lot of people think about because the real horror content of our daily lives is the news. So, I mean, you can't get away from it. You just put it into your work if you're an artist, I guess.
This is going to sound really obvious, but what is it? You mentioned like somebody breaking into the home. What is it about somebody invading your home and coming into it that is scary?
Well, I mean, if you're not there, it's the feeling of violation. Like the idea that like your home should be a safe space. That's the space where you go to get away from everything. So like when that very place that you go to for security is no longer secure, what else do you have? It's like that to me is the horror of it all. And it's the same, you know, even with a car, like cars are mobile or whatever, but like my car's been broken into before and they, you know, they stole some stuff and whatever. It wasn't even about the stuff. It's just the weird thought process of knowing that while you were at dinner or inside of your home or whatever, and you come back to your car and see that someone's been in it and that someone was not you, that's a weird feeling. And it's an indescribable feeling, but it's definitely one that speaks to a violation. And yeah, that's scary.
What are the things that you have in your home, in your personal space, that give you a feeling of security?
You know, that's a good question. What does anybody have? I mean, ultimately, like, I'm just tchotchkes, like my bed. Like, that's my favorite place. That's a safe place, I would like to think. But no, I mean, it's not even that. It's just like being home and being in a space that is yours. Because the things that you have and the things that you take with you through this world ultimately are objects that you place worth on, that maybe don't mean anything to other people, but it's more so that you are able to surround yourself with things that have meaning to you. So I don't know. I mean, I'm giving a very abstract answer to your question, but that's just kind of how I feel about it. It's just sort of like the culmination of the things in my home is what makes it my home. And so that's the safety. It's not necessarily one item like a couch or a picture of like friends or whatever. Although you know, it's nice to have those mementos. It's more so, these are a summation of things that I have assigned personal value to, so they provide a feeling of safety for me, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a sort of a feeling of being simultaneously alone, or at least having some solitude, and also being surrounded and having company, but it's the company of things that you sort of created.
Exactly.
I mean, that must be a bit what it's like to write a screenplay, that you're creating a world and I assume most of your work is fairly solitary in the writing that you do, but also you're doing it by yourself with all of these other characters around you.
Yeah, it's funny because I do enough work, and I'm very grateful for the amount of work that I get to do, because I know it's not always the case for people in my industry, and it's not always the case for me. It is true that sometimes there's feast and sometimes there's famine, but I usually I'm juggling a couple projects at once, and the one thing that I always say to my friends is it's interesting because I'm by myself with so many people. And that means that, like, especially if I'm writing two movies at once, I've got the worlds of these people in my head. Not only do I have to keep them straight, but like I told you earlier, I'm very particular about curating characters and the personalities they have and who they are, that they often feel very real to me. I mean, obviously, I know they're fictional. I'm not Harvey in the James Stewart movie where he just starts talking to people. But I live with these characters for a really long time. And when you write a movie, you live with the script for a very long time. And so it is funny to have like such a solitary job that's so very populated with different personalities that you, in your way, have to put so much energy and effort into understanding, because while they say write what you know, I need to create characters who are outside of my own experience, so I have to find that kernel of what I know about them to build off of that. And sometimes it's exciting, and I think that, you know, I write a lot of characters I like, and sometimes they're the characters you don't, because you have to not like them. And it is. It's interesting. I don't know. I feel like I've lost the way of your question, but it is. You know, it is. There's a lot of alone time, but it's also kind of a chorus of fictional people that live with you while you're doing it.
Do you feel like you've got a better sense of yourself? I mean, because ultimately, all of those fictional people are really you. So, do you feel like you know yourself better through the work that you do?
Sure. And you know, I think the thing is I'm also always learning about myself. I think it would be real easy to say that I have it all figured out. I don't. There are the parts of me that I know are strong, and there are the parts of me that I know need worked on. It's like I said earlier, we're not always the good guy of our own story. And I think of anything by creating fictional people, I've learned to be a better person in the parts of my life that I need to be. And I've also learned about the things that I need to work on. And I think that I also have learned about the things that, like, with putting ego aside, I should be proud about, you know? And I should be like, yeah, that is definitively me. And, you know, it all comes out in the writing, because writing is a very vulnerable thing to do, I think, but it's also a very empowering thing to do. And as with any craft, whether if you're a musician or a painter or a performer, you find the strong parts of your armor and you also find the weaknesses, and hopefully you use them both to your advantage in the creation, but also become aware of them, if that makes sense.
What are your strong parts?
I'm not afraid to take on something, even if it scares me. I believe that I will never learn if I don't try it. I tend to be the kind of person, this is, you know, how you can go from a horror movie to a Christmas movie, to hosting a podcast, to hosting a live show, to maybe writing a comic book or writing a robot story, or like, you know, doing, I will take on, or writing a stage play. I've taken on things that like maybe I didn't have time to do or even the inclination until someone said, hey, you should try that. And then once that seed is there, I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. I want to see, knowing that not everything you do is going to be a success. And I think maybe that's it. I'm not afraid to fail, because one thing that's very important to know in this world of creativity is that you learn from your failures as much as you learn from your successes, sometimes more so. And when you see anyone out there, and I'm not pretending to be anyone important, but I am a working writer and I'm grateful that I get to work. But anybody from like beginning writers to people in my place to people on the A-list, you know, not everything you do is an instant success. But if you can take everything you do and learn from it and grow from it, both as a person and as an artist, then it was what you needed to do. And that to me is something that I've learned about myself, is that I'm willing to kind of put myself on the line and try those things, because it's so important. It's so important. And you know, I look at, you said you were looking at my IMDb earlier. Not all of those projects are beloved by people, and I am the first person to be aware of that. But I will also say, you know what, even though some of them are well-liked by audiences and some are not, I personally love all of them. because they all taught me something and they all took me to the next place that I needed to be. Even if it wasn't necessarily the big red carpet premiere that another one was. It's always a learning curve. And if you're willing to learn and better yourself, then it was exactly what you needed to do.
Yeah, I suppose it's true. Like when you are, when you fail at something in, let's say, a horror film, often that means, well, that character's dead. But now, like in real life, often a failure means, okay, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and try again. You know, you don't actually lose your head for, you know, making a mistake or writing something that people weren't ready for.
Exactly.
What does your family think of the movies that you make?
You know, what's funny is they really think it's a lot of fun. I wasn't sure at first, honestly, when I first started doing this, how they were going to react, especially to some of the like horror content. But when we had a premiere for Tales of Poe at the Egyptian Theater here in LA, my parents flew in from the Pittsburgh area to come and see it. And they were so excited to kind of like be part of all that. When I have movies on TV, my dad goes around his office and tells everyone, you know, this is the time when like Christmas Reunion is airing. And he gets so excited to like tell people. And some of the more subversive things I've done, like I've directed a couple shorts for this queer sketch comedy group called Enemies of Dorothy, and those are very kind of a little bit more subversive humor. They'll like get their friends who they consider woke. I don't know if they know what woke means, but they will bring those people in to watch it. And it's, you know, they also are very patient and listen to me when I call and complain about sort of the uphill climb of this industry. And you know, it's because it is not always easy, and it's a lot of waiting, and it is, for every success there are a lot of no's and a lot of failures. And they've been very patient. And for people who are traditional working people who have been doing, you know, 9-to-5 jobs for years and years and years, It's a tough industry to wrap your mind around, but they've been nothing but supportive. They really dig it. They think the funny thing is like whenever I have events, like when my short just premiered at Outfest, they were bummed they couldn't come. Or like every year that I do Comic-Con, my mom's like, I want to come see your panel at Comic-Con some year. And I don't know that she would particularly love the 200,000 people crowds at Comic-Con, but that she would even want to go. Like, to see my mom in a crowd of, like, Gwen Stacy's and, you know, Sailor Scouts just seems funny to me, but, like, touching. So I'm grateful. You know, I, in this world, I really lucked out. I'm so grateful for my parents all the way back from that moment where she was like, okay, if you want to watch Killer Tomatoes, I'll watch it with you. Because I think that they both had the understanding that, like, I needed to experience things and I needed to carve my own path. And it's like, rather than resist, they supported and, you know, offered advice. And sometimes if I needed a little, like, you know, course correction, they would give some insight. But no, I'm so grateful and I'm so happy for them. And I can't say enough good things, honestly.
Does your mom know that that night where you watched Killer Tomatoes was a turning point for you?
She certainly does now, because honestly, I've been working in indie horror at least. I mean, my career, like I said, has gone through several different iterations, but I've been doing some variation of the horror genre thing for a long time now, and I've done a number of different interviews where I've been asked about my fright origin story, and I, you know, probably without fail mention in some capacity the Killer Tomatoes night. It's not always like, you know, the front and center of the story, but it is so important. And so she's heard me talk about it a number of times. Also in my home here in the hallway, I have a theatrical poster for Attack of the Killer Tomatoes in the hall. So it's like, I kind of like view that as a turning point that I kind of have commemorated in my life. So, and I have since met and talked to John DeBello, who created Killer Tomatoes, and we did an interview piece together for Ultraviolet magazine 5 years ago. He's really cool. Like, so Those vicious veggies, or I guess fatal fruit, depending what school of scientific thought you're on, have always been very important to me, and my mom was there for it, so she knows. She knows.
It's such a, I think, regarded as sort of a schlocky movie, and so delightful that there could be something so cathartic and life-changing there where you were just like, oh, I just want to see this thing late at night. That was the moment that you were like, oh, now I see the path is starting to illuminate before me.
Well, something that I always tell everyone when you're creating art, you cannot create it with the intent of making a piece of art that you want to make you popular or for it to be a big, great big thing, because once you create something and release it to the world, it's going to have the life it's going to have, and you should just be grateful for what that is, because it's like making when you have children, you like, they're going to go out and create their own way, and you just kind of get to be along for the ride. And I, you know, the funny thing about Killer Tomatoes is the best lesson I ever got about this years later, when I interviewed John DiBello, creator of Killer Tomatoes, he told me a story about, because there were four Killer Tomato movies, and the last one was called Killer Tomatoes Eat France, and he got, through a grant in France, the opportunity to shoot the movie there. And there's a joke in it where they're on the river and they are on a boat trying to get attention of someone on the shore, and they're ringing a bell, and someone on the shore says, "Who's that ringing in the Seine?" which is a cheap pun, but he was very proud of that joke. And he said, you know, I was proud of that joke. It cracked me up when I wrote it. And he said, and when we premiered it in Los Angeles to a big audience, the joke comes, "Who's that ringing in the Seine?" And he said, there was nothing, not a peep in the audience. Like, no one made a sound. And then, like, in a delayed reaction, some old guy in the audience started cracking up. And he said, in that moment, I realized I made this movie for that guy. Because if it affected anyone, then even one person, then the work I did its job. And he said to me, he was like, I don't know what you're doing in your life or what you're planning on doing with your life. He said, but always make your movie for that guy. And if you're lucky, that guy's two guys, and those two guys are 10, and those 10 guys are 100 or whatever. But that's it. Make your art for that guy, and you can always be proud of it. Like, and that is, you know, so it's funny because you say, you know, it's so interesting that schlocky movie could end up having an effect or having catharsis. But I guess as a little kid, whether John DiBello knew it or not, he made that movie for me, because that movie led me to this, whatever this is. And I'm grateful to be here. So
where can people find you if they want to connect with you online or follow your show or see some of your film work?
You can find me, my personal Twitter is at Michael Verratti, that's V as in Victor, A-R-R-A-T-I. My show's Twitter handle is at Dead for Filth. Dead for Filth is available on Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, Reverie, and pretty much wherever podcasts are. We come out with episodes every Friday. I've had a number of amazing people on, like Jeffrey Reddick, who created Final Destination, Peaches Christ, Veronica Cartwright's been on the show. We all talk about just the world of horror and queerness and radical ideas, and it's a lot of fun, so please pop by. A lot of my films are just out there in the world. You can stalk my IMDb and choose how you want to find them. I've got some new ones coming out. I think one that might be of interest to your listeners, since I know you've had Peaches Christ on before, Peaches Christ and I are both co-writing a film right now that we'll be shooting in January called Slay Gardens with Jinx Monsoon, so keep your eyes open for that. And yeah, that's just where I'm at.
I am indescribably excited about Slay Gardens.
You know what? Honestly, so are we. It's like, we were so excited to announce it at DragCon, and because Peaches and I have been talking about doing a movie together for a while, and there have also been other movie projects and different iterations of the idea, but then one night we were sitting around while she was doing a gig in LA, and she was doing her makeup, and I was just kind of like railing about something, and it just sort of made sense. This was the project. And as we have been writing the script together, we're just cracking ourselves up, and that's it. Like, you know, it kind of, I guess, goes to that thing, make the kind of movies you want to see, and hopefully other people will follow. So thank you, that means a lot.
Well, Michael, thanks again so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. This was a joy, and it was a very nice, insightful conversation.
Thanks to Michael for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards. Check out my upcoming book, Hi Honey, I'm Homo, for a history of queer characters on American sitcoms. That's at gaysitcoms.com. Visit my YouTube channel for stories about pop culture at youtube.com/mattbaum. And keep up with my projects through my weekly newsletter. You can sign up for that at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.